Maverick and the Machine is sponsored by Jones Plantation Film. If you haven't seen the indie, soon-to-be-cult classic Jones Plantation Film yet, go watch that film. It's available now at jonesplantationfilm.com. That's jonesplantationfilm.com and on a bunch of the other big platforms.
Jones!
Now, let's launch this episode of Maverick in the Machine. Insanity is what I call society. All right, I got a maverick in the building today, a legend, an OG, the great James Corbett. Man, James, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate you doing this.
No problem, Drew. Thanks for talking to me. It's good to see you again. It's been been a while.
Yeah, the last time we saw each other was February of 2020. In Acapulco, so not a lot has happened since then.
Nothing much.
No. That was literally a week before the World War COVID
started. Before the world ended.
Yeah. That was actually your interview, I think, was the one right before or right after I interviewed Larkin, which led to the creation of Jones Plantation.
Yep.
Which is pretty wild. Before we get into it.
When are you going to make a Hollywood movie about me? Come on.
I'll put you in one. I definitely give you a cameo in one. You know, so Barnum World is out now, and that was a mockumentary. We're the next film that we're talking about producing, Charlie Robinson's kind of loosely involved with it. It's going to be a fiction film, and we're going to get investor budget. Hopefully, $1 to $5 million is what we're trying to do. Just enough to they can definitely make their money and we can do what we need to do kind of thing.
Yeah.
We could get you in there because there's going to be a reporter kind of character. It'd be funny to get you in there as a cameo. You're going to have to do it now that I'm thinking about it.
I'm on board.
All right, cool. Okay, so before we get started, I know you've had a very successful career and you've been doing this for a long time, but would you be offended just to give people, a quick, as curt as you want, kind of who you are and what you're all about kind of thing?
I'm deeply offended that there might be a human being on this planet who is not aware of me. But for those few who have not yet heard of my name, yes, I'm James Corbett. I am at CorbettReport.com. And I am a Canadian born and raised who's been living in Japan for the last 20 plus years and started the Corbett Report back in 2007. I talk about politics. I talk about news. I talk about society. I talk about history. I talk about philosophy. I talk about science. I talk about anything and everything I'm interested in, which thankfully is a lot of different things. And I've been doing it, as I say, for over 17 years now. 18? I can't even count. A long time. And there's been a lot of things that have happened along the way. One of the most dramatic, of course, was the rise and fall and rebirth of my YouTube channel. Because I think a lot of people who know me probably know me because of a YouTube video that they saw along the way. My YouTube channel was scrubbed back in 2021, in the depths of the scamdemic, and was just revived about a few weeks ago. I don't know what's going on there, but at any rate, for all those people who thought I fell off the face of the earth, I'm still here. Hello. I've been doing work all this time.
Yeah, you've always been ahead of the curve, because I remember when I interviewed you in Acapulco, you were already... Because you pulled yourself off of YouTube basically before that. You knew they were going to kick you off for somehow, you knew censorship was coming. And I kind of you had that coming. You're like, yeah, I'm getting off YouTube now. And I was like, well, was he crazy? I didn't really know what was coming down the pipe, but you seemed to know that was coming. That crazy. They've lightened it up now, but of course that doesn't really mean a whole lot. You know that's coming again, but yeah, how did you know that was coming?
I did not know specifically what was going to happen. In fact, as we were talking there in February of 2020, I was starting to sense, oh, they may really be pulling the trigger on this one. For people who don't know the context and the background, I've been talking about medical martial law since at least 2009. I had a podcast on it and all of the infrastructure an institutional framework for locking people down and force vaccinating them and all of that that's been put in place specifically over the past 25 years in the wake of the anthrax attacks. Does anyone even remember the anthrax attacks anymore? Probably not, because we were, of course, told at the time, oh my God, this is an Al-Qaeda attack, probably sponsored by Iraq, blah, blah, blah. And then, oops, oh, it seems it came from a U.S. Army base. Well, let's never talk about it again. So people promptly forgot about it. But the people in the biosecurity state didn't forget about it, and they started setting up all of this infrastructure for everything that we saw happening during the scandemic. So I had been talking about this for years. I'd followed this swine flu pandemic of 2009. Anyone remember that? It was this big global freakout and the first example of the public health emergency of international concern that the WHO ever used, which allows them to basically kick in all of these emergency measures and, oh my God, we better order millions and millions of vaccines for everyone, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd seen that freak out. I'd seen the Zika freak out. I'd seen the Ebola freak out.
Zika. There's an old oldie but goodie. I forgot about Zika.
Yeah, you remember encephalitis? All these babies with giant heads. It's Zika, I tell you. And it's coming to America. Remember that? I remember it because I was covering all of these fake hype scares. And so when I saw the initial reporting on COVID, I thought, oh, it's just another one of these fake scares, until I got to the airport in Tokyo to fly to Acapulco, for where we met there in Anarchapulco, and I started to see not Japanese people wearing masks, that's whatever, that's just another Tuesday, it doesn't really matter, but it was foreigners wearing masks at the airport, and I go, oh, okay, maybe something's going, maybe they're really trying to pull the trigger on this one. And of course, we saw what it eventuated into. So I wasn't surprised by anything they tried to pull during it. Of course, I didn't know any of that in particular when we were talking there in February 2020, but I was kind of broadly prepared for what was coming. But specifically on the censorship front, I had been watching for years and years and years and years YouTube's growing tendency towards censorship of various sorts. Of course, it starts as just deranking people, delisting people, demonetizing people, sort of gradually shifting them off towards the periphery. And so I knew it was coming. And I've been talking since at least, I think 2008, 2009 was when I first started saying, hey, everybody seems to be congregating on YouTube. We need alternatives. So at that time, I was talking about, there was an alternative video platform called Veracity Videos at that time. It wasn't very good. It probably couldn't have handled an influx of more than a few hundred viewers at any one time, but it was something. So I was trying to promote it and get people activated on it. Back in 2015, I believe, Ray Vahey heard my call of talking about the censorship that YouTube is going to be doing and started BitChute.com as a result of that, et cetera, et cetera. So I've been talking and warning about this for years and years and years. So when we were talking in 2020, I didn't know specifically what was coming, but I could read the writing on the wall. I always knew that this is a controlled enemy weapons propaganda platform, and I have managed to sneak in the back door and get my information out through it for many years, but it's not going to last forever. So I think that was my general mindset. I continued posting there up until the bitter end, but I knew it was coming, and I was posting videos on almost a weekly basis by 2021 saying they are taking me down. They keep sending me all these messages. They're going to take this channel down. So it's particularly disappointing that so many people, so many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people heard me talking about that. And then when my channel was deleted, they just assumed I just retired or something. I don't know, but no, I'm still at CorbettReport.com where I've always been.
Were you fairly successful in getting most of your audience to your website? I mean, how much did you lose? And the second question is for Corbett Report, do you use a server from, like, where's your server out of? Cause they can just shut your server down too, even if you get out of there, you know?
They sure can. But, I am lucky to be hosted by EuroVPS, which is based in Europe as the name implies. And specifically has, stood up for the free speech rights of some of its clients, because it does host some controversial clients, including, oh man, I should remember the name of this because I've cited them before. They're a good documentation source. But there was a website that that had a lot of, you know, documents, published a lot of documents, including things like the Bilderberg meeting minutes that we have going back to 1954 and all of these sorts of documents. And they had published, for example, the Inspire magazine, the Al-Qaeda magazine that they were publishing back, the glossy magazine they were publishing back in the 2010s and things. And so they had been, that website had been sued, and they'd been, the Bureau of VPS had been pressured to take down this website, but they stood up in court and they fought for them and they did not take it down. So luckily I have a hosting provider that's willing to stand up for free speech. But you know, it, like everything on the internet, it's all of this infrastructure that of course can be turned off, can be, you know, legally gotten at very, in various ways. So I'm under no delusion that the website is there forever and ever, but at least while it's there, please, people, download my stuff. It's all out for free. I don't put anything behind the paywall. So please go and download my stuff and preserve it for posterity.
Yeah, it's a, I'm not just saying this because you hear I'm a subscriber. It's a fabulous website. It's a fabulous resource. And I've always said that, you know, you consider yourself a journalist or a reporter or both? Or obviously you're an author.
You know, it seems like a simple answer, but I've really struggled with what is it that I do? What am I? And mm-hmm. I think that the answer I'm happiest with these days is I'm a teacher of sorts, an educator. I'm not a gumshoe reporter, like on the ground, digging up skeletons, you know, making secret phone calls to my secret sources or anything mm-hmm. of that sort. I am digging up publicly available information, putting it together in a way that hopefully makes sense, and then hopefully explaining it to other people. So I do think of it as a sort of education that I'm doing. So in a way, I think of it as teaching.
And the reason why they hate you is because when you do your work, you're meticulous and you bring the receipts. You show the evidence of what you, and you don't really, you let people make up their own mind based on, oh, isn't this interesting or isn't that interesting kind of thing. And they can't kookify you. And I think that really is because they threw you off of YouTube way, way too early. And it wasn't like you did all your stuff is, it's not like they want the kooks. You know, they want the, something that people can blow some steam off with. With you, it's like, and you had an experience because you did a documentary about the Federal Reserve, which was a huge documentary. And then the degenerate enemy of the people reporter, Chris Hayes. Tell that story.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, I did a documentary on the Federal Reserve in 2014 called Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. And it certainly did take off. It had well over 1 million views on YouTube. And in fact, for some length of time, if you so much as typed Federal Reserve into the YouTube search engine, it was the number one result that came up. So it definitely got some attention. And as a result, I believe it was 2018 that, yes, degenerate enemy of the people, well, whatever phrase you want to use, MSNBC reporter Chris Hayes got on the tweets and started a tweet thread about, imagine if you're a teenager in high school and you're asked to do a report on the Federal Reserve. So you go to YouTube and you type in Federal Reserve and you see this. And he posts a screenshot of the title screen of Century of Enslavement. And he goes on this, you know, rant about, oh, this is, YouTube is radicalizing people and blah, blah, blah. And wouldn't you know it, believe it or not, the very next day after he went on that little tweet storm, suddenly you type Federal Reserve into the YouTube search engine. And of course, Century of Enslavement does not come up. You type Century of Enslavement into the YouTube search engine and Century of Enslavement does not come up. No matter what permutation of words and phrases and Corbett reports and whatever you put in there, you can't find it. Eventually, I found that you could put in some permutation of words that you could kind of find like someone else's post of that video, like 42nd place down on those search results, but you could not find mine. And that was just part of the general delisting, deranking of the Corbett Report that started in the mid-2010s and really continued into the early 2020s, where it was harder and harder to actually find my material on YouTube. And lo and behold, I believe it was part of the release of the Google whistleblower, whose name is going to escape me, but he came out a few years ago. And I think part of the documents that he released showed that, yes, their Corbett Report was part of the thing that they put in the back end, like to derank, you know, don't show this guy's results. So surprise, surprise.
I wonder if, because it was gone the next day, I wonder if they were planning on doing it the next day, and then he was given his marching orders? You know, like, how do these things work?
It's possible.
I mean, can you imagine calling yourself like a reporter to the people and then worried about a report on the Federal Reserve of all things? I mean, that's like, how dare he do this report on child rapists?
You know what? Fair enough. Okay, I get it. If it was full of holes and it was a terrible documentary and it was full of lies and propaganda, but it was not. In fact, one of the best pieces of feedback I ever got about that documentary was from someone, presumably a supporter of mine, and someone who's probably on the same page with regards to the Federal Reserve. But their complaint was, this is almost like a Federal Reserve, you know, press release. It's just quoting the Federal Reserve and their documents. And I'm like, yes, exactly right. That I am not out there on some weird speculative conspiracy limb. I'm just quoting their own documents and quoting official history. This is not some sort of out there stuff. And so that's why, you know, a Chris Hayes just has to vaguely imply there's something threatening and worrying about this. Who is this guy in Japan to make a video about the Federal Reserve? Well, I'm just somebody who's done my homework. And as you say, I have the receipts to prove it. One of the things that I'm always proud of is with my documentaries, there's always a hyperlinked transcript, and every single document, everything I'm talking about is linked there. So you do not have to take my word for it. You go there directly, read it for yourself, come to your own conclusions. I have no doubt there will be people who read the exact same things and come to different conclusions than me. That's great. But all I'm doing is putting my work out there on the table and saying, here it is. And I, you know, as I say, as you say, I have the receipts to prove what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, if you had made some sort of kook piece, they wouldn't have cared. They wouldn't have bothered them. Yeah. That's what bothered them was that you were telling the truth about this fake money system we're living under. Mm-hmm. All right, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Because I could go on like this for the whole time, but I do want to go back a little bit. So where are you from? Where were you born and raised? What's your childhood? I hate the word origin story.
Well, all right, fair enough. I'm not a superhero? Born and raised in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and environs. For anyone who has ever traveled to Alberta, it's not much of a place to speak of, but you know what? Let me stick up for it. Speaking of Maverick, my creative writing professor in university, Aretha Van Herk, wrote a book about Alberta called Mavericks that was about this land of, well, Mavericks. Alberta is sometimes called the Texas of the North. And there are certain analogies that one could draw. It's the oil patch in Canada. It's full of conservative leaning people and salt of the earth ranchers and people like that. Mm-hmm. But it has always been, at the very least, politically, I don't want to say radical, but definitely distrust and dislike the power center in Canada, which is, of course, you know, in the east, the Torontonians, the Ottawa. Yeah, we don't like those people. We want to be our own people. And there's always that kind of independent frontier like spirit of the Albertan people. So I don't know how much of that rubbed off on me, but some of it, I'm sure, is in there. And so I've never exactly liked centralized power and authority. That's some part of my background and my leanings. And that's manifested in different ways over the years. One of the stories I like to tell, I was in grade 4 and I was in a science class, and we were doing some sort of activity. The teacher was asking something like, okay, if you've got this object and you put it in water, is it going to sink or is it going to float? And he took like a class, you know, vote. Who thinks it'll sink? Who thinks it'll float? And I don't remember what it was or what I said. I don't know. I said it would float or something like that. And then he reveals the answer. Yes, you guys are right. It will float. And I was on par. I was one of the right answer people. Yay. Okay. So I think most people at that point just pat themselves on the back, you know, oh, good, I'm right. But actually, for me, that made me think, oh, wait, but why? Why isn't it? Why wouldn't it sink? Because of this or something like this. So I put up my hand and I start arguing against myself and against the right answer that I've just been told, because I'm starting to think, well, actually, shouldn't it be like this? And I think that is part of my background, my character, who I am. I am not just satisfied to be told the right answer, to be told that I'm right. I want to know why, and I want to drill down on that until I am satisfied I know that right answer. And I've always distrusted authority figures of various sorts, including seeing through propaganda. There's a couple of stories I can remember from my childhood. One of them, watching the TV, the evening news with my dad one night, and we watched some report. Again, I don't remember the specifics of it. I just remember seeing this report that was essentially this like 3 or 4 minute advertisement for, hey, this great product that will do this thing, and let's talk to the person who's selling this product. And I just remember, after watching that news report on the news, turning to my dad and going, was that a news report or was that an ad? And he said, I think it's an ad, son. Like, it was just so obvious to me, but I was like 12 years old or something at the time. But yeah, so I've always been interested in trying to see through the propaganda and understand what's being said to me and why, in the context of that. So anyway, all of those pieces are in there somehow, and eventually that eventuated into me going to Trinity College Dublin to get my master's degree in Anglo-Irish literature, which I guess if you're one of those people who believe in authority, that's the only thing I am actually qualified to talk about, because I have a piece of paper that says I'm qualified to talk about it. But it was towards the end of that course, I was just on campus one day and I ran into one of my friends and asked him what he was doing. He said, oh, I'm looking into teaching English in Asia. And I thought, oh, there we go. There's a way to earn a little bit of money, see a new part of the world, kill another year before I decide what I'm going to do with my life. And so next thing I know, I'm on the internet looking it up. And the next thing you know, I'm flying out to Japan to start teaching English for 1 year. 1 year turned into 20 years. And somewhere along the way, I started a family and started the website and all of that. So here I am.
Where are you, I mean, generally speaking, located in Japan?
So I am on the west side of the main island of Honshu, about halfway between Osaka and Hiroshima.
What's that like generally? What's it like over there?
At the moment, very hot. but you're probably not asking about the weather. What do I say? So it is, to some extent, I imagine what most people have as a preconceived idea of the Japanese people and their relation to politics. I'm sure everyone's heard the phrase, the nail that sticks up will be hammered down, and that sort of mentality of a sort of collective mindset among the Japanese people. Okay. And that it does exist certainly here to some extent. But it's also, it is like everywhere else on Earth. Humans are individuals and they express their individuality in the way that their culture allows. And so you do get, of course, mavericks in Japan as well. And I have managed to meet and become acquainted with many of them. But I think that manifests in different ways. Having said that, there are great things about Japan and bad things for anti-authoritarians like myself. One of the good things, for example, during the scamdemic, Japan did not have mandatory lockdowns. There was never an actual masking law or anything of that sort. The police had very little in terms of actual legal authority to do things to people, but they didn't really need it, because Japan is less of a top-down hierarchical boots in the face authoritarian structure. It's more of a horizontal police each other type of structure, where most people are still largely in that mindset of, I am a corporate worker, I work for my company, my boss lays down the law and I will comply. And unfortunately, that is largely what happened here. Most companies had some sort of directive, you will get jabbed, and most people did it. So they didn't really need that legal authority. So in a way, it's good for independent people like myself, because I never legally had to do anything like that and certainly didn't get jabbed. But most people did. And because most people are not economically independent from their companies.
Okay, so in Calgary, you grew up. It's like kind of bleak, but it's kind of like a tough guy area, right? What's going on at home? Do you have brothers and sisters? What'd your dad do? What do your parents do? I know, because we're going to talk about your book, but the foreword in your book, it got me emotional, actually, when you started talking about families and our kids. And it seems like you had a good upbringing.
I certainly did. I could not complain about it. So I had two older brothers, And my mother and father were both from England. They moved out in 1972, I want to say, when my oldest brother was just a baby, before I'd been born. So I was born and raised in Canada. But they were British immigrants, became Canadian citizens, obviously. And so I always had that kind of dual background in a way. I mean, I always knew growing up, my parents were a little bit different than the people around me, but, you know, managing to navigate that. But having said that, one thing that you cannot appreciate when you're a child, but you can grow up to appreciate, is when you have a loving family, of a loving home, supportive parents who truly love and care about you. It's the kind of thing you just kind of take for granted and you don't understand the significance of until you get older and you realize, oh, there's a lot of people who are screwed up in a lot of ways because of a lot of childhood trauma and what have you that I did not have. And I never for a moment doubted that my parents loved me and were trying to support me and take care of me. And part of who I am undoubtedly comes from that love and support, including probably the best thing about being the youngest child. Of course, you know, you get picked on by your older brothers your whole life and all of that stuff. But the best thing about being the youngest brother was that all of the kind of the big battles between parents and children, they'd already been fought by my older brothers. So by the time my parents got to me, number three, I think they knew better how to parent, which is essentially to stop having the battles. And they just trusted and loved me to know, okay, you're going to make this decision. We don't think it's a good decision, but you go and make that decision. We're here to support you and love you, and we'll see how it works. And their trust and faith in me, I think, enabled me to become who I am. And yeah, you know, sometimes it was silly, crazy, whatever. I remember the time, for example, that in university, I was set to become a physics major. And then one weekend, I just snapped and I decided, screw that. I'm going to be an English major. And I remember telling my parents about this decision. And my dad was just saying, okay, well, what are you going to do with that degree? I said, I don't know, frame it? I had no idea. I don't know, whatever. But they supported me. They're like, okay, well, if you want to do this, you do this. We'll do what we can to support you, but, you know, good luck. And it was that kind of faith in me that I think enabled me to actually become what I've become.
Well, when did you become what you became? Was there a moment when you started to, when did you decide? I mean, first of all, obviously, when did you start the Corbett Report? Why did you start the Corbett Report? When did you start to be James Corbett and go, okay, I'm a very different thinking person?
It's a good question. Maybe I haven't yet. Maybe my whole life has been training me to become something that I will still yet to become. Who knows?
I think that's definitely it's true, a good, but you know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. You're definitely just getting going there.
But it's an interesting question. Well, I could point to a number of things. So the genesis of the Corbett Report really was 2006, where I had my falling down the rabbit hole moment where I've told this story many times, but essentially I moved into a new apartment here. It came with an internet connection, and it was the first time I'd had internet in my home for several years since I'd moved out of my parents' house. So instead of going to the internet cafe and downloading a couple podcasts and checking emails.
Remember suddenly, the internet cafe? Oh, I remember the internet cafe. Yeah, that's right. Those are the good old days. I remember that.
The good old days when we were kind of connected, but not quite. But then when I became 24/7 connected, suddenly I could look at, you know, I could download and read and look at whatever I wanted. So I was still fairly normie-ish at the time. And I would watch The Daily Show and Colbert Report and what have you on YouTube. Because remember back when YouTube was the Wild West and everything was just available for free illegally. So I'd look at stuff like that, but I'd always get these recommendations on the sidebar for some wacky conspiracy nut job stuff about 9/11. And I would sometimes click on it just for a laugh, as in like, oh, what kind of nonsense is this? And I find generally there was some silly stuff that was clearly nonsense, but there was some stuff that made me step back and go, I can't be right. I remember, for example, learning about Operation Northwoods and thinking, what, that can't be right. And then going to the National Security Archives and looking up the actual document and seeing, oh yeah, the Joint Chiefs of Staff back in the 1960s literally signed off on a plan to stage and commit terror attacks in the United States in order to gin up a war with Cuba. Wow, that's kind of crazy. And other little tidbits like that. And it was the process. It wasn't even the process of any particular piece of information. It was more the process of me starting to look things up and going, that can't be right. And then I'd go and research it for myself and find it's true. And after a certain amount of that and just the snowball rolling downhill and getting bigger and bigger, I started to realize, this is important stuff and it's the internet age. I better start sharing it. So it was late 2006, early 2007, I decided, well, I better start a podcast. And a few months later, I did it. And I'm not generally a very spontaneous person. So that was kind of strange, kind of unusual for me to just start taking some completely different direction. I mean, I'd never in my life contemplated for a moment that I would be involved in producing media of any kind, other than maybe as a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer, but I never thought I would be a podcaster or vodcaster or whatever I am. But I guess, if you want to look at a moment that was a defining moment, there was one actually after the Corbett Report started. And I don't remember how much after, but maybe several months into the Corbett Report. I remember there was a moment where there were two moments. One was I was posting a video to YouTube called, so it was about the World Trade Center 1993 bombing. And I was talking about the plot that had been fomented by FBI informants and that was being carried out with FBI knowledge that ultimately resulted in the bombing. And so I was sitting there and I'm like, well, the title for this video has to be WTC 93 was an FBI job. And I remember typing that into the search or into the metadata for this video that I was uploading and thinking, I imagine at some point, someone in some intelligence agency or the FBI or something will probably see something like this, right? Like if there is a list, this is the kind of thing that gets you put on a list, right? And I remember thinking to myself, well, so should I maybe not name it that? What should I do here? And I remember thinking, well, no, I don't want to live in a society where there are lists. And if I'm not at the top of the list, what am I doing? I'm probably doing something wrong. So I hit the publish button. And that's kind of one of those moments where you hit the publish button and the first time you do something like that, it's like a big deal and you really think about it and you have to commit yourself. But the thousandth time you do it, it's just another Tuesday. It doesn't matter as much. And I think that's the kind of muscle that people don't even know they have until they start flexing. And so that's part of me. The other moment like that was, again, early on, maybe 2008, maybe 2009. I remember doing sort of ambush journalism sort of thing with regards to, I found that there was a professor at the University of Calgary, where I'd gone for my undergrad degree, who was a member of the Bohemian Grove and had attended the Bohemian Grove. For people who don't know about it, of course, meeting in the Redwoods of California every year, presidents and high-ranking politicians, businessmen, et cetera, to spend a couple of weeks of debauchery in the woods. I'm not even just saying anything. I'm just stating fact. Homosexual. I believe Richard Nixon called it the faggiest goddamn thing he'd ever seen. Right. Something like that. Yeah. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff they get up to. Under this giant owl statue where they commit a mock human sacrifice. I mean, it's the kind of stuff people cannot believe until they see the footage of it. Anyway, so I remember finding out about this University of Calgary professor who was a member of the Bohemian Group. So I, under the pretext of, hey, I want to interview you about your recent editorial in the Calgary Herald, I called him up and then, of course, quickly changed the conversation to, so let's talk about the Bohemian Grove. Have you ever been there with Stephen Harper or anything like that? And he got pretty defensive pretty quickly, clammed up pretty quickly, and ended up hanging up in disgust. And I remember publishing that particular interview and going, this is again the type of thing that certain people might notice, and maybe, do I want to do this? But yeah, okay, well, publish. So, there's moments like that I could point to that are kind of defining in terms of me just committing myself to doing what I do.
Well, I think being in Japan just geographically helps a little bit. It gives you a little bit of cushion than being in, Northern Virginia doing the same thing. So
being in Japan and speaking English is kind of an invisibility power, because 99.9% of people here don't really speak English. So it certainly helps.
So that was 2006 is when that was early on. That was like, I think that was when the year Facebook came out, was like 2006. Wasn't that right around that time?
I believe that was 2004.
Okay. Well, you would know better than me, but that was early, very early in the internet. And at that time, podcast, that was literally only audio, right? You're recording audio and you just basically talking into a mic and then throwing it on the internet kind of thing.
Yep.
You there?
Basically. Yeah. So I had a $20 mic that I bought at the local electronics store here, and I had a beat up old laptop and was doing audio podcasts. But from the time that I started, I quickly realized that this was going to be more than just podcasts. I was going to have to do interviews. I was going to write articles. And of course, YouTube, because everyone's on YouTube and most people are watching videos. So I very quickly started to realize I was going to have to start producing videos as well.
And then you just started the website, and then there you were. When did you start the website?
June 1st, 2007 was the first episode of my podcast.
Huh. Well, what do you think about your career? Like, what's your take on it? Where's this going to go? Like, what do you think is going to happen here? Where are we going to be in 10 years?
You know, it's a very good question, because of the amount of technological change that is happening, I find it difficult to imagine that I will be doing what I do, at least in the way that I do it, 10 years from now. Obviously, the platforms are changing. The content itself is changing. Of course, I am a Canadian, so I know all about Marshall McLuhan, who was the person who wrote Understanding Media. He was a big media professor personality back in the day for media studies. And he wrote about the medium is the message. And I think that has never been more obviously palpably true. Because when you have a media like TikTok, what kind of message can you really convey in a 2-minute breathless, silly, stupidly edited, attention deficit promoting medium like that? What can you actually say? It occurs to me that part of what enabled me to become someone who could be known and whose work would be spread was that YouTube existed as long form videos. When I started, it was the 10-minute upload limit, but very quickly that expanded to 20 minutes, and then it became basically as long as you want. And without that, without the expectation of long form content, let's put it this way. For whatever value those short term 2-minute videos have, that is not what I'm cut out for. I am here for the deep dive, big explorations and going into detail. And that's, again, I'm a teacher. I want to teach people about this. And it's like a university course. If a university professor had to try to summarize everything into some like entertaining 2-minute video, it probably wouldn't be as educational. Similarly with the content that I do, it has to be long form. And that's why Substack has been one of the good media that I've gotten on in the last few years, because most people there are there for long form written textual content, which I am certainly capable of providing. So that's good. But I see going from here, I see the TikToks and YouTube shorts and Instagram stories of the world are clearly what the younger generation are interested in. And how am I going to fit into that world is a big question. And then, of course, on the bigger societal picture, yes, we've seen, of course, the censorship that happened during the scandemic and how it affected myself and many others. But moving forward from here, I imagine that the next big event, whatever that is, will be linked in some way towards some sort of digital ID, some sort of, you know, scan your fingerprint or iris scan in order to get on the internet at all. And do I want to participate in such a system when those systems of control start happening? And you know, to how much, to what extent am I going to compromise my principles in order to even get on the internet at all under such circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. So there are big question marks that I think are right on the horizon with regards to what this work is or how it will be spread in the future. All I know is I'm going to continue doing what I can do in the time that I can do it, but I have no way of foreseeing how many more years I'll be able to do this content in this way.
Yeah, well, you have kids. A small white pill, because my daughter is a middle schooler. I think that those guys are more based and more anti-authority than people can understand. I guess they're Gen Alpha. There's a good chunk of them that are completely brainwashed with the whole trans, this, that, and the other. And then there's a huge chunk of them that absolutely hate this stuff. Want nothing. They know that the system is a scam. I mean, I always tell this, but my daughter was on the phone with one of her friends and they were talking about something and she goes, "You know, all presidents are criminals, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's my daughter." And the platforms like Facebook and stuff, it's getting so blown out with obviously they don't go on Facebook anymore, but all those platforms are getting so blown out with this horseshit AI content, you know, these fake videos and the fake voice. I don't know. I'm talking out my ass, but I predict that most of these kids are going to get, and actually I talked to her about it the other day and she agreed with me. They actually really like their privacy. They're going to get off these platforms and they're going to be in smaller groups on the internet together. And there's going to be live streams where people can go and be with their people. And so in that sense, there's hope let's talk about your book. So you've got a book out and it's a fantastic book. Did you think about, it's called Reportage. Did you think about putting the little enunciation dictionary, how to pronounce it for apes like me? He's a report. I was just thinking about from Pittsburgh, some Pittsburgh guy. Hey, it's book Reportage. You know, it's really good. Yeah, you know, James Corbett, Reportage. I'm like, that's Reportage, man. He's like, Reportage, what are you, French or something? You think you're smart or something? Reportage. but it's awesome. How much does this book cost and where do they get it?
You're going to ask me a retail price and I'm not going to know that off the top of my head. Okay. The best way to get it is reportagebook.com. And from there, there's a direct buy the book link that will, for example, if you're in the United States, it will link you to the Ingram page where you can get it directly from Ingram, which is the distributor for this book. So
it's probably $20 or something. It's not that big of a deal. Yeah.
I think it's under 20, but yeah, don't hold me to that.
Well, you're going to, it's the way it's structured is it's basically a series of essays and you can basically pick it up. You stop me where I'm wrong. And, just read whatever you want in any order that you want. It does have sort of a overarching narrative, but you're going to read it over and over again. Your kids are going to read it. I'm going to make my daughter, because actually the thing that it's worth way more than you're charging, but it has so many references in there that some things I was aware of, some people that I thought I knew a lot more about different libertarian. You talk about Spooner, which, yay, I love Spooner, but there's a lot of other authors in there and things that I haven't actually heard of. The bit about the pencil, the story about the pencil and talk about that. Cause I'm going to make my daughter read that. Cause that is a really profound, and I've heard that before. They use that in sales to train salesmen and stuff. Like, tell me about this pencil. And then they go into the whole thing about the paint tell me about the pencil, man.
Yeah. I'm glad you picked up on that because my audience is probably sick to death of hearing about this, but not enough people in the world have heard about it. Brilliant. It's probably one of my favorite essays because of how simple and effective and profound it is. It's called I, Pencil. It was by Leonard Reed. Whatever you're doing, just make a note of that and go and read that essay because it is truly remarkably effective. But the general concept is, the pencil, the lowly, humble pencil is just boring. And it's the stupidest thing you can think of. Like, this isn't, what's the big deal about a pencil? But he's like, no, the pencil is a miracle, an absolute miracle that speaks to the miracle of human interaction. Why? Because you just see this pencil, this ready-made object that you write on and whatever, it costs 10 cents or whatever it costs, and who cares, right? But think about all of the materials that are in this pencil. And he goes through the lead that's from Ceylon and the paint and the varnish and the timber and all of these different materials that are literally collected from all around the world and that are all shipped to various places for all of this kiln drying and treating and all of these different processes that it goes through and finally assembled together as this pencil that ultimately ends up on your desk. And there are a couple of miraculous things about this. One is that there is no single person in the world who could even itemize, let alone direct, every single part of the production of this pencil, because you're not only talking about the mining of the graphite and the collecting of the rubber and all of these different constituent ingredients. You're also, of course, talking about all of the people who supply the mining tools or the people who supply the trucks and the ships and the planes that are flying these all around the world and the people who are feeding and clothing all of these various workers in all of these industries and et cetera, et cetera. And you start to see, oh, this is sort of a web of human connection that has come together, not through the directed organization of any one particular individual who has made all of this happen. It's all of these people, many, the vast majority of whom have no idea that they are contributing towards the creation of a pencil. That's not even what they're doing. They're doing their specific job and they're getting paid, you know, from their person, and that's all they know about it. But it, all of this web of human interaction adds up to the creation of this pencil and, by extension, of course, every other object that we have around us. And that is a miracle that we so much take for granted that we should not just take for granted. We should be aware of it because it teaches us several important things, one of which is that we do not need a single person directing the efforts of every person in society in order to make the world function. No. Humans are good. As long as everybody's acting in their self-interest, and by the way, self-interest includes, of course, caring for others and caring about the people around you, even if only from the selfish reason, I don't want to live in some dilapidated, you know, state where there's a bunch of homeless, you know, drug addicts on the streets or whatever. I want to live in a nice place where people care about each other and take each other's interests into account. So I want to live in a community like that. So that's in my self-interest. And I will go out and I will do the things that I am good at in exchange for money that I can then use to transact for the things that I want. This system creates this world of incredible comforts and things that we want. And we take that too much for granted at our own risk because it leads people to think that, no, we need some person in some seat of power and authority over everything to direct every single person's efforts in order to make anything happen. That is not how the vast majority of things on the planet happen. And we can find that by looking at the simple little pencil.
Well, you're speaking of something even bigger, which is that, and you talk about it a lot in the book, and that is, what we have now is top-down authority. The whole system is structured for top-down authority. And you speak a lot in this book about what we should be doing and where we could be, what we could be going and be a lot better is spontaneous order, right? Is that what you call spontaneous order?
That is exactly right. To be clear, it's not my term. It's been used many times in many ways by many people, but it is such an important concept because when we think of that word order, we almost invariably think of it in terms of law and order, or we think of it in terms of some order that is being created by someone or enforced by some lawmakers or something like that. But we, again, fail to notice that 99% of our life is lived in spontaneous order. There is no one telling you what to wear every morning. There is no one telling you, you must do this job, you must be this person, you must marry this person. So much of our life is voluntary interaction because we are capable adult human beings who can make decisions for ourselves. And of course we can. And if you had a government that was trying to tell you, you must marry this person and you must work this job, clearly that's tyrannical. And hopefully most Americans and a lot of people around the world would very much disagree with that. But for some reason, we can't extend that towards the other fields of interaction in our lives. No, we still need this governmental force to come in and direct society. I just want people to at least think about, dwell on how much of their life is lived in spontaneous order of voluntary human interaction, and see how far could we extend that? How much do we need that centralized authority? Of course, I have my radical opinion about how much centralized decision-making authority we need. Other people might come to other conclusions, but at the very least, we need to be aware of this term and be aware that it exists.
Yeah, and you say in the book, when you're talking about the pencil, that not only do we not need top-down authority to make the pencil, but actually you could not have a top-down authority system that could actually make the pencil because it's too complex.
Yeah.
One of the things that I like about the way that you talk about, we'll call it voluntarism, spontaneous order, is that you present it in a way that's really, because I get very cynical about it, and I don't know if people can do it. I don't know even if this realm that we're on that is supposed to be like that, but I do know it is a better way. And I know me and you could do it. And now there's some people that we know that we could live in a place and have spontaneous order. But you talk about it in a way that's like, it's so like digestible, it's edible. And you talk about all the horrible things in a way that's very like, it makes me feel better when I hear it. I don't like, because a lot of times I hear it and it gets me very gloomy, you know? Then the perfect example, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes, is your interview on Jimmy Dore, where he's got your book there and you're talking about spontaneous order. And Jimmy's looking at you. And I like Jimmy Dore. You know, I don't agree with a lot of the stuff. I don't agree with a lot of the stuff most people say, but he's looking at you and he's like, you could see the wiring in his brain tricking. But he's like, I can't disagree with anything this guy's saying, but I don't know. I've never heard this. I don't really agree with them. And, you know, it's a really funny interview. I've showed it to a few people where you can literally see him sit there going, and that, you get that in the book. Your prose is really exquisite in the book because you really feel like I'm talking to you. And I was like, well, yeah, he wrote the book. Of course he's talking to you. No, like it's different. It's like when you're watching a great film and the artistic, inspiration of the director's voice is talking to you. It's different. And one of the things that you talk about with all the spontaneous order, this is my biggest bang on, is this is nothing structural. This is nothing obviously political. The only way we're ever going to get there is an evolution of consciousness. We have to have an evolution of consciousness as humanity. And there's no chance that it's going to happen the other way. I don't know what percentage of people need to open up their mind. It's just, it's an evolution. It's not a revolution.
Absolutely right. And I've answered the question before, if there was the magic anarchy switch and you could just flip it and all governments in the world would disappear tomorrow, would you flip it? My answer would be no. Because if we flipped it as things are now, with all of the conscious leanings and baggage of all of the people on the planet, they would just form some form of top-down hierarchy the next day in order to restore order. That's not how this is going to work. That's not the type of revolution that we're looking for. What it has to be is people coming to the realization of spontaneous order, the value of voluntary human interaction, and essentially the faith that actually can work. And the sort of frustrating thing about that is it's not really a radical idea. It's actually a time-tested and time-honored idea. The entire common law system of the United Kingdom, Britain, that as part of the Western jurisprudence that America and other places are based on, that was never based on the idea of laws being written down by a lawmaker and then made into law that are then enforced by law enforcers. That's not the common law system. No, it is a series of adjudications that adhere in a certain locality over long periods of time by people, judges and advocates and people who have an understanding of that history and are able to adopt and adapt it to modern circumstances, etc. And it's this body of judgments that accrue over time that form the sense of what this community is and what it accepts and what is unacceptable, etc. That's, again, more of a spontaneous order sort of idea of law. But these days, when we think of law, we think of the piece of paper, and there's some lawmaker that writes it down and passes it in some legislature, and it becomes the law of the universe. And again, we have to switch our thinking and understand that this not only is possible, it's actually an old, very old idea that has been used in societies before. Why can't we get there again? Well, again, it's probably because of propaganda, conditioning, and education / indoctrination.
Yeah, I mean, if that ever happens, what we're doing now is going to be laughable. It's going to be laughable. We're like, how the hell did we let ourselves get into this position? I did you listen to that interview that Tucker Carlson gave of Ted Cruz that's kind of went around the internet?
I am in the midst of listening to it now, so don't spoil the ending. But I hear
I won't spoil the. It's unbelievable. Look under the hood of these types of people that I don't know where Ted Cruz stands on the hierarchy ladder. I mean, he seems like a true believer to me, but he's also a lying degenerate. So I don't know. He's also a murderer. But how can I say this in a nice way? He is a very fucked up individual. I mean, it's really, really something to listen to that interview. And then the way that they're painting it, like Tucker's this like anti-Semite. I mean, it's just so dumb. I don't know. That'll be interesting. I did get through it, but it's like a 90-minute interview, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Like at about an hour, I had to turn it off for a while because he was making me so disgusted. I couldn't even really listen to him anymore.
I'm about halfway through, and it's already getting a bit tiring. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. God. So in your book, you kind of are pretty positive. Like, and I don't know if you're trying to be positive or you are positive, but do you think that is really where we're headed? Where is this going to go? Are we going to be a voluntary society? Is it possible? Or are we headed to the technate digital prison, in your opinion?
You know, I mean, let's put it this way. So people who read the book will know that the penultimate essay, not the final essay, but the penultimate essay is A Letter to the Future, which I penned in April of 2020. Talking about the direction things were heading at that time and the sort of principles and ideas that people were by their actions or inactions proving that they tacitly supported one way or another, like the concept that we are beholden to the whims of health technocrats or other sorts of technocrats who can decide when and where and under what circumstances we can leave our home or what types of medical interventions we are forced to have, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was a fairly gloomy essay, as you might expect, looking at the possibility that we are seeing the extinguishing of the flame of human freedom once and for all. Now, if I thought that this is it, this is the end and it's done, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you. I would be going, spending my time, whatever, having fun and partying and just living till oblivion, because who cares? It's done. No, obviously, I think that there is a chance. It's not 100% chance. I am not a total optimist and think there's no way that we'll ever, No, I think for me, the best case scenario is that we maintain our humanity, which to me means there will always be good people and bad people, broadly defined. There will be those who are working towards furthering human freedom and voluntary human interaction and those working against it. And there will be times of increasing tyranny, and there will be times of increasing freedom, and there will be a war between those two. It's been the state of humanity since presumably the birth of humanity, at the very least in all of recorded history, and we are living through times like that. My main worry is that, as long as there is humanity, there will be that ineffable, unextinguishable, burning passion for human liberty that exists at least in some segment of the population that will come along to overthrow any tyranny that comes along. But unfortunately, it's not just a circle. It's not just going around. It's a spiral, and it's spiraling towards something. We are heading through not just the sort of the cycle of tyranny and freedom. We're also going through technological revolution all the time. And technological revolution threatens to change humanity at the genomic level, let alone psychopharmaceutical level and everything else. And it is that sort of change that, to me, threatens the human species itself and what it means to be human and whether or not we will go through this cycle of tyranny and freedom for the rest of time or whether we will be technologically enslaved. And for example, I talk about Aldous Huxley and others who have warned and talked about that in the past in the book so people can get more a better understanding of what that means. But essentially, Orwell's vision of a boot on the human face forever is at least a possibility. And again, I think it's the revolution of consciousness that will decide it. Whether enough people understand that threat and the true nature of that threat, being in authoritarian centralized power mindset, or whether they do not. In which case, why not? Let me take the brain chip from Elon Musk or whatever the case may be, and we'll just keep upgrading ourselves until we are no longer really human. And that is my ultimate nightmare scenario and what I'm trying to warn people about.
I think what the big point is there is that this circle of tyranny and freedom, that can't go on forever. Somebody's got to win at some point because they want to lock us down as human beings. They want to take our humanity from us. These people are anti-humans. And most people cannot wrap their head around how wicked these people are, some of them, and what their goals and intentions are, even though they write about it. And they think, oh, you know, most people are just good people trying to do their best in a bad situation, blah, blah, blah. And they don't understand that this cannot, this cycle, this soul, like weak men make strong, you know, weak, bad times make strong men. That's not going to end. I mean, that's going to end. And so we either have to win or lose, in my humble opinion.
Well, then, I hope we win. All I can say is I'm doing what I can to ring the alarm bell and hopefully bring about that revolution of consciousness that is the deciding factor.
Do you believe in God?
I do.
How do you express that?
Well, I was raised as a Protestant, so I understand it in the Christian context, but I certainly don't lecture people about what God is or is not. Mm-hmm. I think that's above my pay grade. I have my own understanding of that. But at the very least, at the very, very least, I know that this is not a materialistic world where it is only matter and particles and a clockwork universe where if you just had all of the inputs and could calculate all of the atoms in the universe, you could understand everything that will ever happen. I certainly don't believe in that sort of materialistic clockwork understanding of the world. There are things like love and hate and evil and good and those sorts of things that are not calculable and you cannot put them in a test tube and measure them, and they do have an effect. And at the very least, if God is the expression of the ultimate good and what we should be striving upwards towards, then at the very least, I know that that's the side I am on. And I am against those anti-human forces that you talk about, that absolutely the predatory elitist class are part of the anti-human class that are trying to suppress us, manipulate us, deceive us, and ultimately turn us into non-humans or whatever. I know which side of that line I'm on and which side I'm striving towards. I'm not here to proselytize to anyone, but that is the way I see the universe.
It's interesting because a lot of times you'll hear people say, well, if there's a God, how come there's so much evil in the world? And to me, like, the amount of evil in the world is proof to me that there's God. Because if there's evil in the world, then there's going to be the equal and opposite reaction to that. And that's the ultimate goodness, right? Mm-hmm. I want to get into one last pragmatic thing. We're coming up on the hour and I don't want to keep you for too long. I don't know what your time's like.
But I do have to get going in a minute here.
Okay. Let's get to the last little bit. So this is important for me personally. One of the things about that you talk about, like I said, you're very approachable, edible. And I find that most of these voluntarist anarchists are terrible communicators, most of them. And there's a real element of like, you dummy, why can't you figure this out? Blah, blah, blah. And you're not like that at all. I got to ask you this. What are your... This immigration thing, all anarchists are the open borders and, no borders and you don't have the right to tell somebody to cross a border, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm always, it drives me crazy because I feel like there's something broken in their brain where they can't understand the difference between immigration and mass migration, which is attack an attack on the local population. And the perfect example is I'm from Pittsburgh. There's a place outside of Pittsburgh called Charleroi. I'm very familiar with that neighborhood. And they dropped 5,000 Haitians on those people, which is an attack on the local population. Whatever you think of what's going to happen or what you think of what Charleroi was, it's now wrecked. And my thing is, for us to take another, to take this step to the future in a positive way, you have to meet people where they're at. And you have to be realistic and live in the world that we actually live in. And so what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I can't give you the satisfying answer on this because I am not a practical and realistic kind of guy. I am very much the kind of guy who sees the principle of the thing and calls it for what it is. So the open border slash private closed border is a false dialectic. The only thing that matters are private borders. Private property of private individuals is sacrosanct, and anything else is a statist construction. So having said that, public land and public borders and all of this is the fake phony fight that happens in the statist world. And I understand we live in the statist world. So people want this sort of, okay, yeah, but given that we live in the statist world, what do you think, James? Well, I want to say I don't care. Insofar as to me, the principle of the matter is that the idea that there's public land that's somehow nebulously co-owned by all of the tax cattle of this plantation, this particular Jones plantation. Well, what? Yeah, but put your vote in the slave suggestion box as to what the plantation owner should do with the borders of this plantation. That's not the type of thing. I don't want to be putting my vote in that slave suggestion box. The only thing that matters is I am a private individual, sovereign human being who can determine the borders of my property, and everyone else can do the same with theirs. And that's the only actual moral solution to this. So, sorry, I can't give you the practical, realistic, what should we do given the status system sort of solution. I don't think that's not the lane that I run in.
You're not just, I don't want to participate. I'm going to live in this advanced or elevated consciousness space, and I don't even care. Okay, that's a good answer. Fair enough. Yeah. All right, people, go get James's book. If whatever you're doing when you're done with this, go get the book. It's not expensive, and I guarantee you, and I don't push anything, and I don't have any stake in this. I'm just telling you, I would never push this book if it wasn't true what I'm saying, that you will get way more value out of this book than what you pay for it. So go get the book. James, before we get out of here, you want to tell them where to find you? CorbettReport.com? That's it?
That is the best place by far. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Odyssey. I'm on Rumble. I'm on BitChute. I'm everywhere. But go to CorbettReport.com. That is the one-stop shop. All my work is there for free. It is a resource. Download it. Enjoy it. Use it however you want.
And sign up for James's upgraded memberships.
Yes. Just to clarify, there are memberships, but membership gives you the access to comment on the website. It gives you access to my newsletter, which consists of an editorial, which I put up to Substack for free every week too. So I would say I actively discourage people from signing up if they're thinking, you know, if I become a member, what do I get out of this? The answer really is kind of nothing. Don't sign up if you want something out of it. Just to sign up, if you are already someone who appreciates my work and has seen a bunch of my stuff and wants to support that work in the future, that's the reason you should sign up as a member.
James, you're the man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Tregsman with 2 G's and an S. We'll also have the links to our subscription and social media in the show notes, wherever you watched or listened to the episode. If you're currently supporting the show and Drew TV, thank you, and we'll see you next week.